With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello, you have found Forum, Nature Biotechnology's podcast, where we speak with leading researchers in the field about their work, about recent publications, either in our pages or elsewhere, or just general topics of interest. And today, we have a roundtable on gene therapy. And this roundtable was run by Marcus Elsner, a senior editor at Nature Biotech, and he's with me now. So the first question is, why gene therapy? Why a roundtable on gene therapy now?
Yeah, there are actually quite a few reasons, quite a few anniversaries that happened last year, happening this year, or will happen next year. So this year, 25 years ago, the American Society for Gene Therapy, or Gene and Cell Therapy, how it is called now, was founded. Last year, 30 years ago, the first human gene therapy trial was started at the NIH with a four-year-old girl called Ashanti De Silva. And next year, 50 years ago, the actual term gene therapy was coined in a paper by Science by Theodore Friedman and Richard Roblin. So yeah, that's quite a few reasons to check in. And in addition to that, we had quite a spectacular clinical trial reported in the New England Journal of Medicine by one of our guests, Donald Cohn, who reported a very successful treatment of severe combined immunodeficiency, which was coincidentally also the first ever disease that was treated with gene therapy all the way back in 1990.
You know, when you say it like that, that the term gene therapy was coined almost 50 years ago, it's amazing. It feels like we're now still just at the beginning of understanding what gene therapy can do, and it's been 50 years.
Yeah, so I mean, it has been quite a ride, along with deaths, unfortunately, safety concerns, efficacy issues. But I think now we have thousands of people in clinical trials, and I think we can expect, hopefully, quite a few more approvals in coming years, also for much more common diseases, as we will hear in the podcast. So yeah, I think it has been quite a ride, but I think we can look forward to more successes in upcoming years.
Right. So can you tell me more about the two guests?
Yeah, so we have Donald Cohn, who has been working, as we will hear in the podcast, on gene therapy since 1985. He's a professor at UCLA. And then we have Kathy High, who is president of Ask Bio, a North Carolina-based biotech. But she's probably better known as a co-founder and former president of Spark Therapeutics, one of the really pioneering companies in the gene therapy field.
Okay, I think that's all we need. So here it is, episode 11 of 4.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Well, first of all, again, thank you very much for making the time. It's a real pleasure to have the two of you here and answering my questions. The first thing I'm interested in is, how did you get interested in gene therapy?
Who started when in the field?
Oh, that's true. Yes. Yeah.
1985 for me.
Well, okay, that's very interesting. I was a hematology fellow, I'm embarrassed to admit it, from 81 to 84. And during that time, I was working in a hemoglobinopathy lab at Yale, in Ed Benz's lab. But the genes for factor 8 and factor 9 were cloned right around that time, in 81 and 84. And I had come from a residency training program that had a very strong background in blood coagulation at UNC Chapel Hill. And after I finished my hematology training program, they offered me a position at UNC Chapel Hill to start as an assistant professor. And I was actually very excited about the prospect of being able to determine the molecular defects in people with hemophilia. And also, they had a dog colony of dogs with hemophilia B. And I was excited about the idea of determining the defect in the dogs and then maybe using them as a platform for developing a gene therapy approach. And that was really how I got interested.
And I was interested in immunology as a resident. There was Richard Hong was a professor there who had been involved in the very first bone marrow transplant for SCID. And so during my pediatric residency in Madison, Wisconsin, I saw several SCID patients. So decided to go and do my fellowship with Michael Blaze at the NIH. And just before I joined him, he had connected with French Anderson to start working on gene therapy for ADA SCID. So I sort of got there right as that program started. And as I like to say, I'm still doing the exact same experiment 35 years later.
Yeah, I realized that this podcast is ideally timed. It's 25 years of ASGCT. It's 31 years since the first actual human gene therapy try with Ashanti Da Silva. It's almost 50 years since Theodore Friedman wrote that science article coining the term gene therapy. One thing that once you got interested in gene therapy that you came up against was, how do I get, after you've identified the responsible genes, how do I get the genes into the right cells? And I'm sure there's been a long history of developing vectors. Maybe you can explain to our listeners what vectors are currently used. Maybe you can start with the ex vivo gene therapy and Don, maybe you can talk about what vectors are we using for ex vivo gene therapy.
Sure. So Inder Verma used to have a slide that said the three biggest issues in gene therapy are delivery, delivery, delivery. And we're still basically struggling with those three problems. So for ex vivo, you know, we're usually talking about hematopoietic stem cells or T cells, both of which proliferate a lot, you know, when they do their normal function. And so it was pretty clear early on you needed something that would be permanently in the genome and would get propagated to the daughter cells. And so the use of mouse retroviruses, you know, developed as a gene delivery tool sort of in the early 80s. And people found ways to sort of gut the viral packaging information out of the virus and put the human passenger gene into them, provide those packaging functions in trans, and make replication defective viruses. And so then there was just a series of iterative improvements because the early biggest concern was recombination between the packaging information and the vector to generate replication competent vector. And so RCR, replication competent retrovirus. In fact, in some of the early studies in monkeys, they got a vector with a lot of replication competent virus and developed lymphoma. So as they do in mice, they could cause that. And so a lot of the early focus was on making more and more changes to the vector and the packaging systems to get rid of any overlap. And, you know, that led to the first trial, as you mentioned, you know, the NIH first trial with T cells used murine gamma retroviral vectors. And then, you know, the other major then event in that area was lentiviral vectors. And there were some initial attempts. Art Nienhuis and a couple of people had tried putting things into HIV, but the major event was at the Salk Institute. Inder Verma, Didier Trono, and Luigi Naldini, then a postdoc, took all the sort of what had been learned of how to make better retros and made lenties. And they had a couple of iterations in the mid-90s, but really the backbone they developed by about 1998 that we call third generation are what we're still using. And to my knowledge, they've never generated replication-competent virus in any of the large-scale manufacturings or any research labs. So they really did solve that problem. And the lenties are more efficient than retros. They have better carrying capacity. They go into non-dividing cells. And so, in a sense, vector development for ex vivo hasn't changed much over the last 25 years. We're still basically using the CCL-RRL backbones that they made.
Don, they also have not been associated with insertional mutagenesis.
Right. In defense of the gamma retroviral vectors, it's really not so much whether it's a retro or lenti. It's what kind of enhancers it carries. And so the retroviruses, you know, we chose them because nature showed these things are capable of expressing very highly from their long terminal repeats because of their strong enhancers. And that's how they cause, you know, murine leukemia. They insert randomly in the genome, and the ones that happen to be next to an oncogene, the enhancers turn them on. And so by the time the lentis came along, that was appreciated. And so they made them with the LTR enhancers self-inactivating or SIN vectors. So I think a lot of the improved safety of the lentis really is the absence of strong enhancers. And for example, in the in vitro transformation assays that are done as preclinical work, lentis that carry strong retroviral long-term repeats as internal promoters can be transforming. So the lentis pattern of insertions may be somewhat less dangerous than the retros because they tend to go throughout the gene body and not concentrating near the five prime ends of the genes. But it's really more whether you're carrying dynamite than whether you get there in a truck or a car is my analogy for that. And so, but you're right that the clinical safety profile for the lentis, you know, I don't know if anyone's keeping track, but there's probably in the range of 1,000 people who've gotten lentiviral vectors into hematopoietic stem cells for a variety of blood cell diseases. And there have been a couple of sort of transient clonal expansions, but there have been no cases of leukemia, whereas they were quite common, unfortunately, with the intact LTR gamma retroviral vectors.
So since we're talking about the constructs that you're actually putting into the lentiviruses, have elements like insulators and other genomic elements, have they contributed to making the constructs safer? Or is that something that is commonly done at the moment to insulate strong enhancers maybe from surrounding genomic sequences?
Yeah, the question of insulators, you know, it hasn't been the big plus that was thought. The hope is, you know, insulators kind of have two functions. They can block enhancers, they can block the virus enhancers from turning on nearby genes. And the other activity insulators can have is blocking heterochromatization from the outside to keep the gene on. And so people have tried them, and a couple have been used in clinical trials. I don't know of really much strong data that says they have their positive attributes. And inadvertently, in fact, one of the clonal expansions that occurred that wound up not being a transformation of leukemia, the first patient to get a lentiviral vector for beta thalassemia by Philippe Lebouche and colleagues had an insulator and one vector integrated in a downstream intron of HMG2A. And the insulator acted as a splice acceptor. So it had a cryptic splice acceptor site in it. And the HMG2A transcript terminated in the vector and lost its 3' tail that's involved in regulation. And so that led to overexpression and a clonal expansion. So there, you know, there's an example of them causing problems. And so I think most people are not using them. There hasn't been the golden one that just, you know, really improves expression or really improves safety. One of the things that we've been doing with Lenti is we're trying to make more sophisticated regulatory elements. You know, a lot of the vectors that are out there have used the CMV promoter, the SV40, elongation factor, alpha, they're kind of constitutive. So we've been looking at trying to bash the gene, the locus for a specific gene, find the regulatory elements, and find ways to parse them down enough you can get them into a lentiviral vector and get physiologic expression. And so we've made some progress in doing that. We had a vector for FOXP3 that used its endogenous elements. It seemed to be quite Treg specific. So I think that's been one of the advances, is trying to get, you know, more precise expression regulation in the context of an inserting vector.
And I guess that's both about cell type specificity and expression levels, right? That you also get endogenous levels.
Right. And, you know, obviously the major competition with that is site-specific gene integration using CRISPR, for example, where you could stick the whole cDNA right after its own promoter and, in theory, you know, recapitulate that normal expression pattern. But, you know, that's not quite there for the clinic yet, and whereas lentis are. And so I think there's at least a window of time in which regulated lentis may be useful for some disorders, where you need not just, like, adenosine deaminase skid has been one of the easiest diseases because you just need some expression and it can be everywhere, whereas other, you know, transgenes obviously have very lineage and temporal specific expression that need to be achieved to get therapeutic safe effect.
So what do we do if we can't isolate the cells and do our gene therapy in vitro?
Obviously, when we started thinking about hemophilia, we were targeting the liver. And as you indicate, it doesn't lend itself well to being removed and then put back in, although there are people who are interested in doing that sort of thing. And so we began to look at everything that was out there, including retroviral vectors and adenoviral vectors and AAV. And we were really agnostic about which vector we used. But what we found once we learned to make AAV, which wasn't easy at the time, was that it clearly has tropism for the liver and was giving us the best results first in mice and then in the dog model of hemophilia. So that was what we chose to move forward with. And maybe similar to Don's experience, you know, each of these vectors becomes an area of study in itself. And so we moved forward with AAV. And of course, it does have tropism for other tissues as well. Again, to echo the comment about delivery, delivery, delivery. If you inject it intravenously, unless you do something special to make it avoid the liver, most of it will go there, but it will transduce other tissues that you can reach intravenously, like the heart and the skeletal muscle. And so in addition to those tropisms, I mean, the other very attractive feature of AAV is that it is predominantly non-integrating. So you have less concern about issues related to insertional mutagenesis. And, you know, as we know now for both AAV and for retroviral and lentiviral vectors, I mean, there's a regulatory path that has led to approved products. So all of those things make AAV attractive as a vector. And of course, there are many diseases that you can target, that you can address targeting the liver, not just hemophilia.
So can the fact that the DNA is not integrated in the genome, I guess if you have dividing cells, that also might cause problems, that you maybe lose the expression.
Yes, and for sure, this is an important constraint. So going into rapidly dividing target cells will more or less assure that you will have only transient expression. Sometimes, of course, that's what you want. But most of the time, we're looking for long-term expression. And then you can't go into rapidly dividing target cells because you will lose expression of a non-integrating vector in that circumstance.
Historically, I was just intrigued by that when I did my research for the interview. How did we settle on mainly two vectors that are used for, I think, the vast majority of all gene therapy trials? Because there are many, many more viruses that infect humans. But it seems that all the trials have been conducted with basically three kinds, AAV, adenoviruses, and either lenti or retroviruses. How did that happen?
Well, my answer is that it's survival of the fittest.
Yes.
I mean, that it has to do with their efficacy as well as ease of manufacturing and titering and all those other things that are important for clinical application and for the regulators.
Yeah, and among the viral viruses, they're relatively simple. And therefore, they're relatively simple to make sort of into a binary system of packaging elements and vector backbone. You know, a lot of other vectors have been looked at. Herpes virus for NERS, for example, much more complicated virus. You know, adenovirus is very efficient delivery, but it's very inflammatory. And so I think it's really lost. It's hard to think of a clinical situation where AAV wouldn't be safer and, you know, have the same efficacy to a large extent. And so,
For some oncology indications, right?
Yeah.
Pro-inflammatory is good. So
right, the oncolytic viruses and it is for that. That's about all it's really being used for, I think. Not for you know, genetic disease where you need lifelong persistence.
Yeah, or vaccines, as I can attest to having received the AstraZeneca vaccine.
It's a feature, not a bug, that it's inflammatory.
Exactly. So do you think there are better vectors out there that we can find or engineer? I mean, I know that there are a lot of efforts to engineer better vectors. So where do you see the signs of these viral vectors going?
Well, you know, I think, you know, there's been a lot of effort for non-viral delivery and nanoparticles. And I'm a little nano-skeptical. And to the present time, I haven't seen many of those have the favorable properties these viral vectors have of efficiency, of persistence. And so, but I think there's a lot of effort to make hybrids with, you know, a variety of different materials. And so I think there will be effective in vivo delivery systems to, for example, target the hematopoietic stem cells in the bone marrow rather than having to take them out and give chemotherapy before you give them back. So that's really a very, you know, for sickle cell disease, for example, a really critical unmet need is ability to do in vivo gene therapy with an injection rather than a month in the hospital getting cytoreductive chemotherapy. And so there's still a huge need for improved delivery methods. But, you know, the viruses spent many years evolving to be very efficient, and they still are.
You know, what I would say about AAV, yes, I think there's still a great deal to do in terms of engineering the capsid to alter tropism, to either specifically detarget certain tissues or to target them. So I think there's still a lot to do in terms of that. Selecting for specific features like the ability to cross the blood-brain barrier, increasing the number of options we have for that. I think that one of the areas of greatest interest for people who work on AAV is to make the vector more efficient in the sense that the number of particles we give to get transduction of X number of cells, I mean, we really have particles in vast excess of the number of cells we're transducing. And so there is some lack of efficiency there. And, you know, better understanding of the steps that block transduction or that render it less efficient would be an area that could make a big difference. In dosing, which would help to solve some of the challenges in the manufacturing supply constraints, as right now the demand for AAV manufacturing far outstrips the worldwide capacity to supply it. So I think there are a lot of avenues for additional research that could make a difference. I mean, I will say that I think lipid nanoparticles have made great strides over the last decade, and they're critical for gene editing in the liver, for example. So I'm excited about the ability to target at least one tissue with lipid nanoparticles. I don't know how quickly we'll see other tissues come online.
I think Intellia's data on ATTR actually looked quite good for CRISPR gene editing. So I think especially for AAV, I think it's a bit less of an issue for lentiviruses as cargo capacity. I know for genome editing, that's a huge constraint, but I guess it must be, for depending on what gene you want to deliver, quite a big constraint for classical gene therapy too. I guess for AAVs, there's very little one can do about that, or Can you engineer larger cargo capacity?
Well, I think people are certainly interested in that. I was a chemistry major in college, but I took a lot of physics courses. One thing I learned is that you can't fight physics. So when you have a capsid that's a certain size, you know, there's you're not going to pack more DNA into it than than the capsid size can accommodate. So you're going to have to look for some other solution to that. But, you know, we've actually addressed a number of conditions that have cDNAs that don't fit into AAV. So, for example, in hemophilia A, people have shown using protein therapeutics that you can cut out the large central B domain and you still have a functional factor VIII gene. And similarly, in the trials for Duchenne muscular dystrophy, people have engineered many dystrophins that seem to, you know, seem to be having a therapeutic effect. So I do think that there is a good way to marry some of the exciting work that's gone on in protein engineering with the constraints of AAV carrying capacity and get therapeutic outcomes.
Kathy, how efficient does the approach of sort of splitting the gene into two different viruses and co-delivering them work for AAV? I don't know, you know, how I know that's an approach that's looked at. I don't know how effective it is.
There are situations where that can work. For example, if the protein itself has two halves and they can actually be assembled intracellularly. And people have done that for hemophilia A, for example, for the factor VIII gene. Just had one vector that makes one part and another vector that makes another. Of course, then you've got to get both vectors into a single cell unless they can assemble in the bloodstream. You know, in general, as an approach, I'm less enthusiastic about that or about the splicing approaches or intine approaches. You know, things where you eventually put things together. To me, if you can truncate the protein, then every transduction event is a successful event. You don't need two transduction events. You know.
I actually don't know. So in an AAV, you can fit about 4.5 kilobases of sequence.
You can go up to about 5 kb before it starts falling off. But anyway, go ahead. Sorry. You were trying to get the lenti.
Exactly. So how much can you fit into in a clinical lentivirus?
Right. So HIV's genome, I believe, is about 10 kb for the whole thing. But it turns out that when you make lentiviral vectors, there's a direct drop-off in titer as you make more insert. And so we've spent a lot of time with beta globin vectors that tend to need a large set of regulatory elements to get high level of expression. And they're notoriously low titer, poor transduction. And we actually had a paper last year showing that, you know, with a series of increasing size of payloads, there's just a direct drop off in titer. And in fact, even there's it's even worse than that because these longer vectors at any given MOI or concentration transduce less efficiently because they have incomplete genomes. So we think that during transcription from the packaging plasmid or the vector plasm during packaging, you get incomplete RNA genomes formed the longer the virus is. So more of the virus are carrying defective genomes that can't reverse transcribe. So they're almost like defective interfering particles. And so it's really important to minimize the payload. And so 4 to 6 kb of insert is good. Once you start getting above that, you know, titers really start falling off. We've tried various ways to try and improve the processivity of the RNA during packaging, but haven't really made a major impact on that.
I guess another limitation for in vivo gene therapy is pre-existing immunity and the difficulties with redosing. So are there approaches to circumvent those issues?
Well, yeah, again, people, I think, have looked at a number of different strategies for that. You know, Marcus, I'm a hematologist, so I, you know, My own orientation would be that there are a lot of potential strategies for getting rid of antibodies, at least transiently, which is really all you need to get an AAV vector infused intravenously. But, I mean, for example, there are physical methods like plasmapheresis. There are drugs that will stop the production of B cells and plasma cells, at least transiently. And there is there's a recently approved drug in Europe, an endopeptidase that specifically cleaves IgGs. It's actually approved for preventing antibody-dependent killing in renal transplantation, but it may have applications for pre-existing antibodies to AAV as well.
One thing we already talked about a bit is safety. Before you test a new gene therapy in people, how does preclinical testing look like? What do you do before you start your clinical trial? Maybe, Don, you can start.
Sure. So there's a series of assays you can do to test the relative safety of the vectors. And so, you know, I talked earlier about the retroviral vectors that had strong transforming LTRs. And so one of the, there's an in vitro assay where you take murine bone marrow hematopoietic stem cells, you transduce them with the vector or the control or mock, and then you culture them for a couple of weeks. And all the true stem cells will exhaust during that time unless they got transformed by the vector. So then you do a limiting dilution plating, and the number of colonies you get formed is really quite a good readout of the sort of the genotoxicity of the vector. So if you have a lenti that has kind of a bland internal promoter, you get no colonies formed because the cell is exhausted. Whereas if you put in one of these retroviruses with a strong LTR, you get many colonies. So that's actually, I think that's one of the better assays because it gives you a nice quantitative logical outcome. You know, the other studies are doing in vivo tox studies where you put them into a mouse, you either put in human cells with the vector or mouse cells with the vector, you transplant 25, 50 mice, and you look for tumors or other genotoxicity, which almost is never seen in those models. And so I think, you know, you're testing only a fraction of a patient dose, and the occurrences that happened in patients occurred over 2 to 5 years, not over the 3 to 4 months to do those. While they're traditionally done and, you know, the FDA typically wants them done, I think their predictive value is relatively weak. You can look, you know, also in the cells that have been in the mice for 4 months, are there expansions of clones with the vectors near oncogenes? So that's sort of the kind of tip. It's mainly genotoxicity that's looked for in the preclinical studies.
Yeah, so because AAVs are administered in vivo, typically most of the preclinical work is done also in the same way. And, you know, a very extensive package would be in two species, injecting the vector into two different species, using the same route of administration that would be used in the clinic, and looking for any toxicity, and also trying to use those studies as well as allometric scaling to accurately estimate a starting dose in humans. I think the problem we've had with the AAV is that people who are experienced in drug development know that side effects in humans are accurately predicted by work in animals about 70% of the time, which means that you will encounter things in human subjects that were not predicted by the studies in animals. And of course, we did see that very clearly with AAV. And, you know, there are multiple examples of that. But perhaps one of the most striking was that people had given AAV into the respiratory tract in people with cystic fibrosis, into skeletal muscle in people with DMD, Duchenne muscular dystrophy, or actually in hemophilia B, but that the very brisk immune responses that occurred when AAV was administered intravenously were not predicted by animals who are mostly naive to AAV, whereas humans have memory, immunological memory to AAV, and were not predicted by the earlier studies in the respiratory tract or in skeletal muscle.
Have you gotten any better in predicting side effects over the last 30 years?
Well, I mean, to the extent that the early work uncovers them so that you can plan for them in advance. but are we better at predicting them with a new class of therapeutics? I'm not sure I would hazard a guess on that.
But so I guess question is, are you, you know, how often are steroids or other things given prophylactically to try and prevent immune response to the capsids. Has that become sort of a standard thing, or is it trial by trial decides whether there's some trigger to give them or whether they're just given on some schedule?
Yeah. Well, the response, as you know, is dose dependent. So if you're giving relatively low doses, it would typically be given only if needed. Whereas if you're giving very high doses, such as people given the Duchenne muscular dystrophy trials, it would be more common to make a provision for, or as is done in Zolgensma, right? I mean, all those children are on high-dose steroids beginning before the vector is infused. So again, it's dose dependent. It's also route of administration dependent. I mean, you know, direct injection of AAV into the central nervous system hasn't really been associated with immune responses.
Yeah, maybe we can look a bit into the future. I think currently all clinical development programs for gene therapy target monogenetic diseases. So will we move to more complex diseases anytime soon, or are we still having our hands full with the monogenetic diseases?
Well, of course, you know, the other major application as a disease category is cancer.
Of course, and, yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, and so, you know, I still think of CAR T cells as a form of gene therapy, you know, so that's obviously been incredibly effective. I mean, it's one of the biggest revolutions, I think, in medicine in my career. The ability to, you know, take a patient's T cells, engineer them, and eliminate their cancer, and so that's obviously been, you know, and there's many, many more applications, obviously, in great need in oncology. You know, the more complex diseases, I if it's a multigenic problem, I think the likely approach would be to express some other molecule that's going to affect the process. But I think you know, again, the complex traits are going to be much more difficult to approach with gene therapy. The monogenic, you know, one gene, one disorder, it's one gene, one treatment. And so they are much easier to approach.
Yeah, I think I would just add to that. If you look at the gene therapies that have been approved to date, which except for the CAR T cells are all for single gene disorders, the striking thing is that almost all of these have been approved on trials of a handful of patients, dozens of patients. Not the sort of thing that we see with small molecule drugs for cardiovascular disease, for example, where you see thousands of patients enrolled in the trial. I mean, and what that tells you is the power of supplying the missing gene to the physiologically relevant target tissue, right? And Scott Gottlieb, one of the former FDA commissioners, noted that for gene therapies, in contrast to other classes of therapeutics, you know, maybe you spend 20% of your time reviewing the clinical results. They're usually clear cut. And you spend 80% of your time reviewing the CMC portion of the application, right? Because it's the product that is complex, not the interpretation of the clinical data. So that's one point that I would make. I will say that I think the things that I look forward to, I believe that in the next 5 years, we're going to have licensed drugs for some very large single gene disorders that everybody is familiar with based on, you know, television, the movies, and so forth. I think we're going to have a licensed product for sickle cell disease, and it may be a gene editing product, or it may be a lentiviral product, but that's huge. I mean, whether you have to come into the hospital and do bone marrow conditioning or not, that's just huge. I mean, you know, I think we'll have a product for Duchenne muscular dystrophy. I think we'll have a product for hemophilia. And these are single gene disorder. I mean, all of the approved gene therapies at this point are, I would say, fairly obscure diseases. I mean, they may be well known to pediatric neurologists or to ophthalmologists who take care of children born with congenital blindness, but you know they're not diseases that in the popular imagination are important inherited diseases. And so I think that will be a very big event over the next 5 years. I think that will change people's perception of gene therapy. You know, the question about these complex acquired disorders, there is actually work already going on. For example, in age-related macular degeneration, there are multiple trials ongoing, There are other older trials that failed. There are trials of gene therapy for Parkinson's disease. AskBio is doing one. There are trials going on for heart failure. But Don is right that most of these are really multifactorial etiology. And my own feeling is that these may be more like oncology, where the response rates you get with a single agent are typically not very good. But if you put three or four of these agents together, you may go from a 15% response rate for each one of those individually to a 75% response rate. And so it may be that for some of these adult neurodegenerative diseases like Parkinson's or age-related macular degeneration, or for conditions like heart failure, you may actually need more than one gene-based treatment to get a therapeutic outcome in more than a narrow subset of the patients.
I think that's probably a nice way to end the podcast. Thank you. Thank you very much. That was super insightful. I really, really enjoyed talking to you.
Okay, we've reached the end of episode 11 of Forum. Our thanks to Kathy and Don for participating in this. Obviously, we could not have done that without you. If you'd like to comment on this show, on Nature Biotechnology, or anything that the journal does, you can find us on Twitter. Our handle is @NatureBiotech. And if you'd like to subscribe to this podcast, search Nature Biotechnology and Forum wherever you get your podcast, and you'll find it. And you can also subscribe to our two other podcasts, First Rounders, and our 10-part series on antisense out now called Hope Lies in Dreams. Okay, that's all. There will be another Forum coming shortly. Until then.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Traffic jams, tailgating, pileups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit EnergyCitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.
Want your most burning finance and investing questions answered? Here's a podcast you should be listening to, courtesy of Acast Recommends.
Are you ready for some personality in your personal finances? Hi, I'm Janice Torres Rodriguez, Latina money expert and host of the award-winning podcast, Yo Quiero Dinero. On this show, we're serving up POC-friendly personal finance knowledge, always with a side of sass. We're not talking about avocado toast and lattes on this show. We've got real, relatable personal finance knowledge that makes you feel seen, heard, and finally understood. Consider me your super cool, slightly risque, but always honest financial fairy godmother. Together, we'll tackle dinero in a fresh new way so you can finally become poderosa with your dinero. Check out our weekly podcast episodes at YoQuieroDineroPodcast.com or subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.